that is then determined by your deal flow. Do you actually have three other bets that are better or as good? And that's really the, I think, the art of the discipline here is knowing when to use four bullets to hit the target versus, you know, just, hey, and we have this happen all the time. And the way I've now taught my team to do it, because we now have 11 people on the investment team, is I've taught these young folks to say, okay, in our accelerator, we're investing at a $1.7 million valuation, right? So in order to own 7% of that, $10 million company, I've spent $700K. Okay, would you rather make 525K bets, 525K bets, or own 7% of this one at 10 million? And compare it. This is a very easy way to do it. Look at the accelerator class that just graduated with 12 startups. Is this, where would this company rank in there in that group? If it ranks number one, where it's like by far number one, it's better than all 12. Okay, you got a case to make. If it ranks number five or six of those 12, well, then why are we doing that?
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your idea into a beautiful website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Lemon.io. Hire pre-vetted remote developers and get 15% off your first 4 weeks of developer time at lemon.io/twist. And Public. You take investing seriously. Public does too. Build a multi-asset portfolio and earn an industry-leading 4.1% APY on your cash with no fees or minimums. Learn more at public.com/twist. Hey, welcome back to Twist, This Week in Startups. My name is Alex, and we have an investor panel for you today, including our homegrown champion, Jason Calacanis from both Founder University and the Launch Accelerator. And then we have Ryan Hoover, best known for tweets, cat pictures, and the fact that he is a founder over at The Weekend Fund. And then we have Sophia Amoruso from Trust Fund over in the UK. Sophia, Ryan, Jason, how are we all doing?
I'm in Park City, and really excited to see you, Sophia and Ryan. It's been too long. Ryan, such an amazing founder. He did Product Hunt. Still, I mean, founders today, Ryan, still my portfolio companies. Will you share us on Product Hunt? I mean, you built something that lasts. That's got to feel pretty good, huh?
It's been almost 12 years, which is insane. I'm starting to feel really old. I don't know. When I was 25, you know, talking to all these, in my eyes, 35 old men, you know, VCs, I was like, wow, these guys are kind of old. Now I'm 38. I'm one of those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens quick.
And The Weekend Fund is on its third fund, Ryan, I believe.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah. And then Sophia, your venture capital firm Trust Fund is still on its first fund, according to filings that I could find.
That is correct. Yep.
It's fund all right. One. And Jason, you're on launch four, I think.
Yeah. I'm on a fourth fund. And then arguably I'd say it's really our fifth because my Angel List portfolio and my Sequoia Scouts portfolio kind of predate that. And that would have been like fund zero. So probably fund four is the official fund name, but it might be fund five. And I've got to make a decision in the next year. Do I do fund five or do I retire or do I just work for my own balance sheet, which is what happens to a lot of funds. I think Homebrew decided to go off their own balance sheet. I don't know if we've seen this a couple of times, but sometimes you get to the point where you're like, the process of raising money from LPs takes so much time, is so painful, requires so much communication post that if you have the ability to just work from your own balance sheet, you just eliminate, I don't know, what does it take you, Sophia, in your first fund to raise money and communicate with your LPs versus actually doing the job of finding and investing in companies in year one percentage?
Yeah. Year one, it was like, yeah, I would say 20% of the time was talking to, you know, founders, and the rest of it was fundraising. The fundraising didn't take too long. I think I spent a lot more time with funds of funds and institutional investors who weren't right for the size fund that, you know, that I was building or for fund one. So I could have done it more quickly if I had just focused on individuals and people that I knew and the people who ultimately made up my LP base, including you. People like Mark Andreessen and Hotshots, David Sachs, your buddy.
Gotta collect them all. Gotta get all the besties from the next one.
All of them.
It's happened a couple of times.
I can continue.
Yeah. Yeah, we have, I don't know if there's a fund with all four, but my friend Sandeep Madra, who's now sold his company to Grok, all four of us were investors in his last company and the company before that. But that's more of a poker table thing. He always, when he would raise money, would just at the poker table say, I have a 200, like last time was like, I have a 250K allocation for besties, you know, first come, first serve, whatever. And I was like, yeah, no, that's great. But, you know, I'm going to provide a little more value. So like a 750K, but nobody needs to know, whatever. And he's like, yep, every single person said the same thing. You're all just at 250.
He invested in the fund. He invested in trust fund because we were at the table.
Yeah.
And you were like, you're investing. He was like, okay, 50K. I was like, yeah, that was easy.
A little peer pressure. Yeah. I was like, we gotta get the ball rolling here for Sophia.
Honestly, like I raised a lot of money at the poker table, like not just your, you know, poker table, but sitting around getting to know people, under, you know, you talk to people, you know, and then there's other people there who might vouch for you and be like, oh yeah, something about this person, you know, Anthony Noto from SoFi played, you know, poker with at the, you know, Code conference. And poker is just, I'm telling you, Ryan.
It's the new golf. You get to know people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It kind of works. Ryan, you had an incredible advantage. And that was, by the way, the last time I hosted my Sky Dayton, myself and Brooke Hammerling would host a poker game at the Code conference. That was the last Code conference. The last time I hosted the poker game there. Because Kara Swisher kind of hated me, I guess, at the end and, you know, hated Sachs and hated tech people, entrepreneurs, the whole thing. So it was like, it just became untenable because we would have some of the press there, but the press hated the CEOs and the VCs. So every year for 15 years, 20 years of doing it, I just watched as like the animosity between the two groups grew. To the point at which I was like, why am I putting these two groups of people who hate each other in the same room? And then I was like, fuck it. I'm just taking the best one, Alex, for myself. I'm taking him out of the journalism ghetto and I'm taking him for my side.
I was just thinking that if you really want to have people who don't get along, the poker table is the best place to do it because it's the only place where it's socially acceptable to lie and steal from one another.
Yeah.
Within the rules of the game. It's perfect.
Ryan, you had a big advantage with your first fund, I think, because you had sold to AngelList at that time, or you were doing a syndicate or something, maybe. How's it going for you raising funds and that part of the business? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, the first fund, it was shortly after Product Hunt sold to AngelList. I stayed on as CEO for 4 years afterwards, but raised the first fund, and my goal was $1 million. I was like, I'm going to try to raise $1 million fund. That grew to 3 million. So like way oversubscribed, massive fund, 3 million. And yeah, being in the flow and, you know, a lot of my like former investors who, you know, backed me and the team at Product Hunt were LPs and still are. So yeah, there's some advantages there for sure. And then honestly, it's, we'll see how the market is. We're not raising now, but we will, you know, in the future, and it's changed a lot. The current fund that we're in right now was raised in 21, and we all know, you know, 2021 was a very bullish time. And it was, to be honest, not that difficult to raise, relatively speaking, to what I've heard from other GPs, especially like emerging managers right now. So we'll see.
You snuck in the window because when Silicon Valley Bank blew up and Lena Khan took the reins, that was the end of the innocence. Like it was so enthusiastic, and then there was just 4 years of complete depression. Which Sophia, you got to raise during.
Yeah, I mean, I was raising at a time when, you know, it was 2023, when it's like a couple years old. And I think that everybody was talking about the bloodbath of the managers who had raised during 2021 and that they've invested in these companies with these wild valuations and that, you know, I was in a period where there was a correction, but also there was the, what do you call it, when, you know, funds hadn't marked down, their private, you know, they were over allocated on venture. It was a weird time where the market had dropped, but, you know, funds hadn't marked down their portfolios. So, but yeah, I'm glad I didn't raise in 2021 because I also know, just speaking to fund managers who raised their first funds in 2021, they weren't getting the hard questions that I was getting. Because it was much, you know, easier to raise. And so I feel like it not being the easiest or raising in a different environment forced me to learn how to answer questions that from what I've been told, some emerging managers didn't have to because of the environment at the time.
Your website is so important. It's how your company makes its first impression, and that's why Squarespace is here to help you design a beautiful, professional, attention-grabbing website in just a few simple steps. Maybe you want to show the world your amazing portfolio. Maybe you need to tell your potential customers about your service and share some testimonials. Well, Squarespace is the all-in-one tool you need for your business to grow and flourish. Squarespace offers stunning templates for every type of site. They've been at this for over a decade, so you can start an online course, you can schedule appointments, and you can generate client invoices all with just a few easy clicks. They are obsessed with their customers. Their editor is incredibly fast and intuitive. Anybody can learn to use it. And it even works on your favorite mobile device. Plus, they've got this new AI-powered feature. It's called Blueprint. And it makes it easier than ever before to customize your web design and make it pop. Okay, squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. That's squarespace.com/twist. Hey, and after you make it, show me your Squarespace on Twitter. And maybe I'll give you a little reply, a like. Maybe I'll even retweet your new beautiful Squarespace website. Yeah, mark to market. Putting your marks, I guess, is the term you were looking for, Sophia. People use all different terms for it.
I want to go back to microfunds, though, because this is interesting. Ryan, you sent over some data from AngelList that said essentially emerging managers, smaller venture capital funds, are having a much better time through Q2 fundraising than they were Q1, Q4 of last year, et cetera. So it seems that there's been a bit of a resurgence in LP interest in smaller venture capital funds. And I'm just curious, Ryan, have you noticed that shift amongst your own LP base? And is that going to change your fundraising schedule, bringing it up, perhaps?
I'll have a much better perspective when we start raising, because that's when you actually really know, are people actually going to invest? They often like reach out and say, hey, are you raising? We get those emails. I'm sure, Sophia, you get those emails all the time. But you never know until they actually write the check. But yeah, I'm in touch with Avaloq and the AngelList team, and they reported between Q1 and Q2 this year, 43% increase in LP capital into the AngelList platform, which is sort of an index of a number of funds, maybe skewed a little bit slightly towards like syndicates, SPVs, and smaller funds. But that's a huge, huge increase. And, you know, part of it, my theory is we're seeing a lot of optimism around AI, of course. We're seeing, you know, Figma being like the you know, one IPO that's going out that hopefully will inspire more liquidity in our ecosystem. And so I think we may see a rebound. Who knows, though? I'm not going to try and predict the macro. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm just, you know, continuing to invest.
I'll predict the macro. You know, there's like a greed fear index, and we're now deep in the greed index. And I think we were from Silicon Valley Bank blowing up, Trump presidency, Kamala presidency, both of those, I think, were big unknown scaries for people. Like, is it going to be like Trump has gone wild? Is it going to be Kamala's raising tax rate, you know, raising more taxes, and, you know, could be actual chaos? So uncertainty of the past 2 years combined with, you know, no optimism and no distributions, I think led everybody to be at greed. I would say, yeah, it's interesting it came up as a 69 there. I was going to put it at 420. But
that's,
I think we're
birthday.
I didn't know you were pricing Tesla robotaxi rides.
Wait,
there,
your birthday's 420, Sophia?
Yeah. All my friends ditched school on my birthday. I was so lonely.
It all makes sense now. So I think we're heading into a greed cycle where people are starting to have FOMO and greed again. I missed out on this round. I don't own SpaceX. I don't own Stripe. I don't own Anduril. How do I get those? Oh my God, Humane Robots is the next big thing, but they have no revenue, but they're doing an SPV at, what was that, 30 or 40 billion. They may have a customer, BMW, but BMW said they're not really using it in production, but maybe they are using it in production. Like, all of that are the signals to me that greed is trumping fear. And that's good until people lack discipline in their entry prices for, you know, people in our line of work, seed and pre-seed, which is where you get yourself in a ton of trouble. So anyway, good time to be playing the game, and the distributions are going to make people frisky. When that Figma goes out, with Circle going out, CoreWeave going out, I think we're just going to see tons of money start to recycle all of those things. Doesn't surprise me. AngelList is the tip of the spear.
Yeah, valuations are also up. Avalok was sharing some numbers. Pre-seed is flat, according to them. Seed is up 15%. Series A is up almost 10%. Series Bs are up 40%. Now, maybe that's a smaller sample. Hard to measure the full macro on that. But valuations are high. It's a lot different when I started Weekend Fund. Average entry price, I think, was like $6.5 million post.
Is that a pre-seed or a seed number, Ryan?
That was over the entire fund. Combination of seed and pre-seed. And that was like the median, I believe. Much lower than what we're seeing right now in the market.
Hmm.
That's
Ryan,
absolutely
crazy. What valuation and stage do you target? Like, what's your, I've heard funds that are like, we don't invest past 15 million post. And it's like, there's a lot that you're going to miss, right? But discipline's important. As a fund manager, it was so much more fun as an angel being able to invest at like any stage. But it's one thing that I know LPs will evaluate our funds by is how much we stuck to what it was that we said our fund construction was going to be when we talked to them, the first time.
Yeah. I mean, I constantly question myself on this. We do have some price awareness, not maybe sensitivity is maybe not the right word, but awareness. We do pass on deals sometimes when the valuation seems extremely high and it's like pre-launch and there's not a lot of like objective proof points. But at the same time, we're also hit to kind of play the game, play the ball. What's the metaphor? Play the field.
Play the game on the field.
Play the game on the field. Yeah. And we obviously don't want to miss out on the best company. So, We're reevaluating a lot of that right now, actually, and thinking through even our strategy in the next fund and how we deploy capital. Historically, we've written about 300K average check size. Our goal is to have every company, if it a unicorn or above, like could return the fund. But the reality is the valuations are getting much higher. Also, the optimistic approach is, hey, what is $1 billion? Like today's billion unicorn is tomorrow's 10 billion, decacorn. These companies are getting big very quick. And if you look at just how, I hate to say AI, but AI is also eating into more of the market. It's going to eat into services in terms of like the GDP of the world. And so you can actually see some of these companies that used to be unicorns be much bigger today. So
that's an interesting point, Ryan, because it's almost the snake's eating its tail. If we succeed with these AI companies, then we lower the revenue and here we go. That could be problematic. I think about it in like how many bullets you have in the gun, right? And sometimes you're like, well, this is a really good target. I'm willing to take three shots at it, which is like triple the valuation. And so when I organize our fund, hey, we're going to have 300 names in this $45 million fund. Our average ownership is going to be 6%. At a 6% average ownership, get diluted to 3%. We need approximately a unicorn in the $1.5 billion space to return the fund. Every investment has to have the potential to be a unicorn, or why are we making the investment? Which means it has to have a great team, good product velocity and going after a big market. And so then you have to ask yourself, is this worth, if I'm paying instead of 6 million, if that's your average valuation, okay, there's a 24 million. Okay, am I better off making this one bet or making four bets? And that is then determined by your deal flow. Do you actually have three other bets that are better or as good? And that's really the art of the discipline here is knowing when to use four bullets to hit the target versus, just, hey. And we have this happen all the time. And the way I've now taught my team to do it, because we now have 11 people on the investment team, is I've taught these young folks to say, okay, in our accelerator, we're investing at a $1.7 million valuation, right? So in order to own 7% of that $10 million company, I've spent 700K. Okay, would you rather make 525K bets, 525K bets, or own 7% of this one at 10 million? And compare it. This is a very easy way to do it. Look at the accelerator class that just graduated with 12 startups. Where would this company rank in that group? If it ranks number one, or it's like by far number one, it's better than all 12, okay, you got a case to make. If it ranks number five or six of those 12, well, then why are we doing that instead of doing another accelerator class? Because we have so many people who want to come to accelerate. Now that assumes you have an accelerator people want to go to and that are high quality enough. So this is the thinking on everybody's mind, exactly what you're going through, Ryan. And Sophia, you're going to have how many names in your fund? Where did
probably
you wind
like
up at?
22. I'm at 14.
Okay. Wow.
More concentrated than I had anticipated, but I've also done some follow-ons with some of the companies that I really, really believe in. And it's just much easier to, like, you know, throw my weight around for the guys that are going to, like, knock it out of the park than I think continue investing in companies that are going to still need a lot from me, but, you know, I have less, you know, I have less data to operate on. So I'm curious about, you know, everybody in these, you know, with these like micro funds is like no reserves, no reserves. But I'm also like, you know, just, I think math aside, logic tells me to double down on a winner, right? Like, I think just everybody like believes in that. You give an employee a promotion, whatever that is, you don't.
When you're a busy founder, finding a new developer, my God, that can become a full-time job, and you've got enough on your plate. I mean, you're running a startup, but Lemon.io has done the hard part for you already. They've got a crop of pre-vetted developers that they've ensured are experienced, results-oriented, and prepared to make an impact at your startup. And they can work right now at competitive rates. These are skilled, hand-picked devs with a minimum of 3 years of on-the-job experience. And just 1% of applicants are accepted into their program. Lemon.io isn't just recruiting you the top talent that's out there. They're helping you integrate them into your team. If anything goes wrong, Lemon will find you a replacement developer ASAP. And many of our launch founders and founder university companies have staffed up with Lemon.io, and we always get the best feedback. So go to lemon.io/twist and find the perfect developer or even a tech team in less than 48 hours. And Twist listeners get 15% off their first 4 weeks. Stop burning money. Hire developers smarter. Visit lemon.io/twist.
Sophia, what are your criteria for making a follow-on investment? What's the standout thing you're seeing in those companies that makes you want to deploy more capital into them? Is it revenue velocity, product velocity?
Revenue, traction, speed of development. So, you know, two of the pre-seed, I invested in two pre-seed companies of the 14. And both of those guys went on to raise really big seed rounds. And I think when it hasn't been very long since I've spoken to the founder, but the product has moved so quickly that I need to touch base with them to ask how to describe it next time I talk to somebody or when I'm going on a podcast. I think that's a really good signal. And, you know, it's like Nectar Social, for example, like these, it's two sisters, they're ex-Meta, one's an ex-Meta, ex-product folks, and they live in Seattle, and it had been, I don't know how long, maybe 6 months from the time they raised with just a deck. And, you know, Mizba, the co-founder, came over to my house and showed me this product. And I was like, holy shit, like, this is something I wish I had, you know, at Nasty Gal. This is something, you know, every brand needs. And now it's like, you know, they're working with Olipop and Jones Road Beauty. They just signed on Goop. Like, they've got like real revenue. And the product is like, I use the product for my social media. It's like, you know, it's for brands, but I use it for certain like AI kind of automation stuff. And, you know, my mind was just really blown. And what I think founders are, you know, are able to do now with AI, you know, punch above their weight, being able to use these tools and have teeny tiny little teams is really encouraging. So also the founders who are, you know, taking advantage of that and either scaling down or staying small as they go from pre-seed to seed is something.
So we've talked about revenue growth and also how fast they're shipping and also these team sizes. I feel like we're really circling this that he describes as the new status symbols in Silicon Valley. And if you're on the audio version, it says that raising is now revenue, press is now social reach, credentials is now shipping, and big teams are now small teams. Jason and I have talked a lot about the static team size thing, but Ryan, it sounds like Sophia and you are in pretty close agreement about what's changed in the startup game.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're seeing a lot more people showing off their revenue numbers on Twitter, and it's creating, I mean, I'm not going to lie, like sometimes some FOMO. I'm like, oh shit, like I didn't even see this company. Oh my gosh, they're making like $50 million in revenue in the first 12 months. Like, this is insane. And so you're seeing a shift in how people are pumping their chest, whether we like it or not. Like, revenue is the new status symbol beyond just raising. Now, raising still matters. Like, if you get, you know, brand name firm backing you, that still matters, but that's secondary to revenue at this point. And also it's a leading indicator into getting those funds, obviously, interested in what you're building. You also see a massive shift, of course, in the past decade from like press to social. And in many ways, like Twitter's become the new launchpad in many cases, partially because the algorithmic changes. If you think about it, like before, if you were a no-name founder, you probably had, most people don't have a large social following. You put something on Twitter, you don't get a lot of play. Now you have an algorithm. It heavily incentivizes videos for like demos. And, you know, this is changing a lot of how founders are sort of playing the status game and showing off what they're building and what they've achieved. And so it's very different than when I, you know, moved to San Francisco in 2010 today.
Signaling is like, go ahead. Okay, sorry for you.
No, is it okay if I ask questions?
You are, that makes it a dynamic discussion.
I'm not the host.
No, that's when it's at its best.
You know, I'm just so, I'm exhausted. I don't even make that much content and I'm fried. Like,
you make a lot of content. What are you talking about? You are
not like
three,
you.
Four stories a day. We just make different things. I make four podcasts a week. You make what? Three or four social clips a day?
I mean, stories are just so lazy, but like, you know, sure. Startups have to like create content. Maybe not, but fund managers, like some of these guys have like massive TikTok presences and you know, I feel like the older I get, the less capacity I have, like in general, to just do anything. And I don't know if that's like brain fog or like hormones or laziness or perspective or, you know, work-life balance, which I don't like, that's not something I think a lot about, but.
That's a big statement from you because your advantage, your unfair advantage is your massive social media following. And that's what draws in a lot of founders and that you're high profile. But you know, there's something very interesting in the signaling, Ryan, that I think you pointed out, which is the For You page means you could be a nobody and the algorithm will put you in front of the somebodies. That's distinctly different than being like a reply guy and trying to like being Keith Raboy's replies. You put out a great video, you put your revenue numbers, it trends. Keith Raboy sees it, Sophia sees it, you see it, I see it, Alex sees it, or people put out like the Cluely video or the response video to it, like all that stuff, you just wind up seeing it. So now you're aware of it and it's part of the overall trend. I would say there's like two trends here, going direct and then the For You page surfacing nobodies, you know, like outsiders being able to get in front of insiders. Those are actually two very interesting things we've surfaced here. But I like the idea that signaling is changing and that people are looking for, you know, if you have revenue and then the next thing will be profits. So you will see, I'm starting to see some founders.
Profits? We don't care about profits. We just
need to literally have a founder. I've had two founders this week when they sent their note say, we have 20% margins right now. Two different ones. One's a media business and the other one is like a SaaS business. And they were like, I'm like, we're reporting on profits now. I'm like, how are you deploying those profits? Are we paying taxes this year? Or are we investing in that, you know, in something? Because that's what we want to do. But signaling is super critical for founders to understand and for investors to understand because it kind of creates a shared dialogue. What you were talking about before about like the product velocity, Sophia, I like to come up with terms and the term we use internally, so we actually have our own vernacular, is product velocity. When we see a founder with product velocity, that means something. And then we have a specific criteria for follow-on investments to Alex's original really good question. The other thing you didn't mention, but by name, but that you insinuated was, hey, they raised money. And then I saw that company, Nectar Social, had raised money from True Ventures and Google Ventures. Our criteria is revenue growth, lead investor joining the board, and the track record of that lead investor. And so if we're going to follow on, if you have 3, 4, 5x revenue growth, we're following on, like that's rare. And if you have a lead investor who I know, or we know, who's notable, who's invested in a great company before, how did you convince them? Now, there's two possibilities. Either your company's great and they recognize that and decided to lead it and join the board. So joining the board is a subset of that criteria, because a drive-by 250K check from a large fund, not really good. So in that case, I'm guessing True Ventures is either joining the fund or put in more than 250, 500K. Every time you turn on the news, it's about AI getting smarter and smarter. These models are writing perfect code. They're acing the world's most difficult exams. And it turns out they're also pretty good at making money. That's why there's Public.com, the investing platform for people who take their money seriously. What really sets Public apart are their AI-powered tools and features. Check this out. You can ask Public a question about any stock in plain language and get a straightforward answer. If you want to see why a particular stock's price jumped or crashed, they've got a clickable AI-generated summary right there in the performance chart. You can build multi-asset portfolios on Public. Stocks, bonds, options, obviously, but hey, maybe you want a little crypto in there, some ETFs. I will advise you to try public.com and access industry-leading yields like 4.1% APY on your cash with no fees or minimums. Plus, for a limited time, earn 1% match on all IRA deposits, IRA transfers, and 401k rollovers. Never too soon to get that retirement dialed in. So go to public.com/twist today to fund your new account in 5 minutes or less. That's public.com/twist. Disclaimer, paid for by Public Investing. Full disclosures in podcast description.
Yeah, they co-led. They co-led the
And is round. One of them joining the board?
Yeah, I think Tony did it. Frederick may have. But like, you know, as a first time, you know, fund manager to be like, you know, there was like some random Texas firm had leaned in and wanted to preempt something. And I was like, guys, who are you talking? They don't have relationships in the Valley. And I was like, you guys should talk to like the big boys. Let me introduce you to Frederick and Tony. And then I introduced them to one other top tier firm that's like a dream firm. And, you know, all of them wanted to lead. And GV and True are basically like, okay, we'll co-lead. We're not going to get, you know, the 20% allocation that we want, but we'll each get 10%. And it was like, they just showed up and were like, who are these freaks? What is this? This is so amazing. That was it. It was just like on the merit of what they had built. And it wasn't, yeah, their relationships or anything. I certainly can't convince anybody to invest. It's not like, I don't have that kind of influence to be like, ooh, you know, but for me to be like, I don't know what I'm, you know, I haven't invested in that many pre-seed companies, even as an angel, but to be able to send it upstream and have like, you know,
the massive advantage you do have and the value you're providing to those is you validated them with your time and skin in the game. So therefore, when Tony looks at it, he says, well, Sophia's got 22 bullets in her fund. I heard this week in startups, she used one of her 22 bullets. That actually, skin in the game means something. And I think that's a massive advantage that pre-seed funds provide to seed funds or seed funds provide to Series A. And that's kind of what makes the ecosystem work. The other notable thing, I don't know if we have more data to bring this, to reground this, Alex, but the other thing you mentioned, the Series Bs were massively up. This makes sense to me, Ryan, because you have so many of these mega funds with billions of dollars. And for them, they have to put more money to work. And, you know, that is going to lead to valuation increases. So then that leads us to the discussion. We had a company this week we invested in 2 years ago, kind of maybe call it a $15 million valuation. Maybe three years later, they're at a $500 million valuation. Do we sell 20% of our ownership and send distributions since that investment is now theoretically 30x, that would be 32x. Do we trim 10, 20%? Or do we take our pro rata or do we do both? Syndicate our pro rata. What do you think, Ryan? How do you think about when you trim a position? Because distributions are rare and the opportunity to distribute is rare. What's your current philosophy on that?
Yeah, we've done this once. We did this about 18 months ago. We invested in the seed round of deal in the first fund, and that was a 10 mil post. It's gone on, you know, I think the last round was on $12 billion valuation. And 18 months ago, we're like, well, okay, we have an opportunity to sell 14% of our position to return the fund.
And that's a 400X return roughly?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like 10X fund returner on paper. And, you know, we'll see. It doesn't count until it's true DPI, but we're like, well, let's get one DPI, 1X DPI.
The spy thing isn't going to sink your DPI. You'll be okay.
Yeah. We'll see. No, I'm bullish. I'm bullish on the company. I was bullish back then. I'm bullish now. And granted, we did sell lower than the $12 billion number back then, because this is also when the market was also in the slumps a little bit. But the thought was, okay, one, our LPs, they've been, you know, they're going to be so happy to see some liquidity. No one's getting liquidity like 18 months ago. Two, we're still going to have 84%, 83% of our position remaining. So even if we make a mistake and it, you know, 10x's from here, we're still good. So we did make that decision, and it was the right one, even though today it would sell for like more than 2x, you know, in the market from what we sold back then. But so anyway, to answer your question, Jason, I don't know. It's so subjective. I think it's wise for early stage funds, maybe after five, six, seven, you know, 8 years in their positions, to start thinking about liquidity and take 20, 30% off the table, even if they have high confidence that, you know, it's going to go up from there.
My best advice.
About recycling, yeah. Recycling. Teach me about recycling.
I actually have thoughts on that too. My best advice is, if you have an opportunity, since they're so rare, take it, sell 10 to 20% twice, maybe three times. And then by the end of the story, you have 70% of what you could have had. No LP is going to be upset about that. And they're quite the opposite, because if you gave them that money, you know, 18 months ago, and then they put it into Sophia's fund, they're looking at it as, you know, okay, there's a time value to money too. And then what if that company implodes? And that specific company had like a lawsuit and a couple of challenges, if I remember correctly, with their competitors. And so I had a company that got to a $1 billion valuation. We sold 18 million of our position. We kept 80%. That company's now worth $300 or $400 million. We look like, and that was 2 years, 3 years ago, we sold it. We look like geniuses, returned the fund. Our syndicate got a bunch of money. And so, and we did it with Calm. I personally did it with Uber right when Masayoshi-san was offering to buy shares in the 30s. Now it seems crazy with Uber at 90 that I sold in the 30s. I feel great about that trade because I bought a house that doubled in value during that time. So then the truth is, with the time value of money, maybe I left a third of 15% of my investment. It just doesn't matter. What does matter is downside protection. So that's my sort of take on it. And man, I have two regrets. I was offered to sell some Robinhood at $30 a share, and we wound up distributing at, I think, $14 a share. When we distributed, I told everybody, hold your shares, because it went public and we were pre-seed investors. You know, some people sold it, some people held it. That $14, now it's at $100. So that fund, the difference would have been like a, I don't know, 10x fund versus a 3x fund if you held your shares or whatever. 4x fund versus 10x. I don't have the math in front of me, but it's significant. So I was like, oh, maybe I should have held my shares in Robinhood and held on to the public shares and distributed them 2 years later, which is what Sequoia has been doing quite effectively.
Yeah, it's at 107 right now, Jason.
Oh, what am I doing on this podcast? I'm rich. Bye. I'm gonna go mountain biking. What am I doing here? No, it's like I woke up one day and like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in Robinhood shares that I got as my carry turned into millions of dollars in Robinhood shares. It's a great thing about being a VC. If you love the company when it was private and it makes it to public, why would you sell it when it's public? Like, unless the founders aren't there or something dramatic happened. I mean, obviously you have to re-underwrite it every year or every 6 months. But man, let your winners ride.
And Jason, answering your question about Q2 Series B valuations, I have that for you right here, which, as you can see, they are going up much like every other round. But the biggest gains that we're seeing are in the super late stage, the D plus era of venture. Does that match, Jason, what you expected to see?
Yes. There's so much late stage money available because companies aren't going public until LPs and GPs see companies going public earlier, they're going to keep making these late stage investments out of their, what would have been their public allocation. They'll just be like, okay, I'll buy Stripe, SpaceX, Anduril here before they go public, because, you know, those companies probably should have gone public already.
So on the point you made about profitability earlier, Jason, is that what happens when we have smaller team sizes and just faster revenue growth? Because to me, it sounds like startups are just getting more efficient overall. I'm curious if it's more of a mindset shift, or if it's more just, this is what happens when you spend less money by hiring fewer people.
I mean, we've seen this step function happen, I think, three times in my career, like client server, cloud computing / mobile, that time period, and then now with AI. So if you keep lowering the time it takes to get a product to market and the amount of money. It used to be a year or two to get a product to market and $5 to $10 million. Then it became like $1 million in 6 months. And now it's 6 weeks in an accelerator and $50,000 to get a product to market. I mean, it's not even comparable. So many more startup bets to make. That's why I'm trying to increase the surface area. That's my big, if I have any realization this year compared to last year, is that surface area really matters, because there's just so many more companies. So you have to take many more meetings, place many more bets. To your point, Ryan, like, how did I not know about that company? That was Sequoia's experience when Techstars, Y Combinator, and AngelList came out. They're like, how do I not know about these companies? And they're like, I guess we can't know about them. There's just too many companies. Now it's, I think we're going to see, I don't know what Cambrian explosion means other than a big one. So somebody educate me, what is Cambrian? But whatever Cambrian, it sounds good, sounds intelligent, but I think it's like a 10X. I think we'll be sitting here in 2 years and have 10 times as many startups hitting, you know, product market fit than we did 5 years ago.
The Cambrian explosion, Jason, was about 500 million years ago, and it was a rapid diversification of types of life. And the main hypothesis is that there's more oxygen, so more life got started.
Yeah, so that, I knew that. I was testing you, Alex. I knew the Cambrian implosion.
Well, now people, I only knew half of that. So
now anyone, and it's going to get better and better, can build, use software to build their solutions. And so historically, you'd have some accountant in the Midwest maybe who really understands their space, understands their customers, understands their own problem. They can at least build like an MVP. And yeah, maybe the vibe coded tools are not production ready. You know, call back to T perhaps. I don't know if it was vibe coded or not, but you know, had some security issues. But it's going to get better and better. And so I think the number, not think, it's pretty clear to me that the number of builders are going to increase. Now, whether those are all startups and like venture backable companies is another question. But we're going to see a lot more building and creating and shipping.
So Sophia, speaking of this, yeah. I just invested. This is the first angel check I've written since I started the fund, because I just have been really focused on the fund. But the founder of Lovable DM'd me like a week ago and was like, hey, we should do stuff together. And we got on a call and they were like, we want you to angel invest. And it's like, I think, you know, it's not going to be like a huge check, but, you know, they're the fastest growing startup ever. They just reached 100 million in ARR 8 months after launching the product. They're at like a $1.8 billion valuation.
Anton from Lovable. Yeah, I had him on the pod. It's a very impressive piece of software for this vibe coding.
It really is. And this is kind of exactly what we're talking about. People are creating software in 48 hours and generating like tens of thousands of dollars worth of revenue on it. And these are just, you know, these aren't even necessarily startup founders. So I'm curious, I mean, I don't know, how much time have you spent thinking about something like Lovable? And like, as an angel, that's like, I think that's probably, I don't know if it's the highest, you know, it's not late, but it's probably maybe the most expensive check I've ever written. Do you think
Am I making a good decision? What's the sale price to sales ratio? Price being the valuation of the company, sales being the revenue of the company. Price to sales should really just be valuation to revenue, would be a cleaner way to say it so people would understand it. So is it a $1 billion company now or $10 billion company?
It's $1.8 billion, but in 8 months, they've reached $100 million in ARR.
So it's 18 times sales.
So the velocity is like...
So the question is, will that sales continue? And the thing I'm hearing against this, Sophia, is people are sampling these products at an extraordinary rate. I would say similar to when apps came out. Remember, you'd buy a flashlight app for $1 or you buy a game for $2.99 and like play it for 5 minutes and then never do it because you're like, well, it's only $3. Paying $20 for Lovable or any AI product, you use it for a couple of hours and then you cancel it, or you use it for 3 months, you cancel it. That's going to be the question, is that quality revenue or is it brittle revenue? What's the revenue? Is it durable revenue?
Yeah.
I think is the way I would say it versus brittle.
Like, yeah. What's their churn look like?
And the way you can determine that is when you talk to the customers. Is this an essential part of their workflow? Is anybody here ripping out Slack or Notion or Coda if you use those things? Like, I can't imagine ripping that out of my company or Google Docs ever.
Have you seen Craft?
Use the glue? Is that glue or?
No, it's like Notion, but easier to look at.
Oh, really? I don't know that one. Craft, it's really, it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I use Notion Coda, but once you get deep.
The last LP update.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And once you get into it,
it looks great. It was very well designed.
So I guess, Ryan, what are your thoughts on brittle versus resilient revenue?
Well, obviously, churn matters and retention matters and everything. But also, there's this interesting time where, so Vatica, my partner on the fund, and I have chatted a bit about this more recently, and she wrote a blog post about this. Maybe I'll share the show notes or something later. But we're in an interesting time where the foundational layer, the foundational models that everyone is building upon are just getting better and better. And so without you as a builder, founder, doing anything, theoretically, your product is just getting better. And there are certain use cases where it hasn't reached that tipping point where the utility has met consumers' needs, but it will over time. And you building on top of these foundational layers, you don't need to do the heavy work. Not that it's difficult to build everything around it, but you know, there's so much opportunity coming, and it's almost more about being in position and capturing users so that when the foundational models and AI is good enough to solve the problem that you're promising, then you're there. And so that's actually a shift. It's very different than like cloud infrastructure. When cloud infrastructure came around, that like shifted, you know, cloud computing, SaaS, all of that shifted dramatically, but that was more binary. It was like you put it in the cloud or you didn't. Like maybe got a little faster, maybe got a little bit cheaper, but it didn't foundationally change your underlying product and offering. And so this is something
that's
that we're
profound,
looking at.
This is a profound insight, Ryan. It's so good to talk to you. I haven't talked to you in a year, but you always have these like really good insights. So what you're saying is, imagine if your AWS account, your S3 storage made your product better while you didn't ship any new product. That's like a really interesting thing, because there's you improving your product and then there's your underlying technology improving your product. So you could argue like AWS got cheaper or the storage got cheaper, or maybe it got marginally faster, but that's not the same as what LLM's advancing is doing. Sophia, are you going to make that outside of your fund or inside of your fund?
Outside of the fund. I mean, it's not, I'm investing at like sub 20 million.
You got to talk to your LPAC, make sure as one of your LPs, I'm saying put it in the fund and make an exception. And it's a learning experience.
I haven't done it yet, but I think it's like, I don't think it would be a challenging 10X. And I think if I was, you know,
do it in the fund.
I have relationships with founders, even though I'm not like a lead check, I've found it pretty easy to contact a founder when they like, you know,
of course,
raise subsequent fundraising and be like, hey, anybody want to buy, you know, can I sell some secondary shares? So, you know,
do it
like
as an LP, I would say, do it in the fund and say, this is an experiment. We have 22 bets we're making. One of the bets, we thought we'd try a later stage one and see what we learn there. And, you know, obviously we don't think this could be a 200X, but we think it'd be a 10X, and that could be accretive to the fund. And, you know, it would be a single or double, and it would be lower risk. So we're going to maybe experiment in this fund and the next fund and having a couple of those if it's a special circumstance where I have access. I did that with Cloud Kitchens. I have access to, and I'm friends with Travis. I had the opportunity to invest in his fund and my third fund for Cloud Kitchens. It was an extraordinarily high out of, you know, our normal investment zone, but I put 10% of the fund in because I was like, I can bet on Travis to 10X 10% of the fund and return the fund. If he doubles it, great. If he triples it, great. It's all accretive. And I have unique access. So that's like the unique access carve out that as an LP in your fund, I would be really upset if you didn't take it.
I mean, it's a tiny check. It's just the ownership, like all of it.
Don't worry about ownership. Just worry about what you think the return is.
Yeah.
If you think it's low chance of not returning and it's high chance of returning low single digits, it fills in the fund. It may not be a fund.
No, I think I feel good about it. I wouldn't be considering it as an angel check if I didn't. So
in order to return the fund, if you have 22 bets in the fund, it has to be 20X. So that's going to be hard to do. But I mean, 5X would be
like
possible.
Wix is worth like 20 or 30 million or something like that.
Billion.
Billion. It's like,
feels like it. It's so funny you bring up that company, because I was in a meeting with Kelly, who's running our syndicate, and I was asking for an update. And she said, yeah, I'm building a new portal. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. We hired a company to do that, or we got a freelance developer. She's like, no, I'm building it. I've been vibe coding in Lovable. Wanted to show it to you. It's a little early, but here's what it is. And I was like, oh, you could build a portal like AngelList, you know, for our private syndicate without being a coder. Okay, interesting. It feels like there's something big there. Sophia, we had a hanging question about recycling. You recycle 10% of your fund, Ryan? What's in your docs? What do you do?
So both recycling and follow on is flexible. So we don't have anything that's like strict in our LPA or anything like that. My position with follow on and that kind of flows into recycling a bit is, or it's related, I should say, is on the follow on side, it's like, if we believe in this company, like if all things being equal, even if we're not an investor, would we invest in this company at this valuation today, knowing what we know now? With regards to recycling, we recycle within a certain time period generally. So if we get returns, sometimes companies shut down, they return the capital, we recycle that capital. But if it's year six of a fund, year five of funds, we tend to distribute from there. I mean, by then we're also on another fund entirely. So that's how we've approached it.
Yeah, I've recycled, I think, 10% in a couple of the funds that we've done. You know, it's... You have to play the game on the field, I think, Sophia, since you were asking for advice. And for me, the game on the field is, if there's no DPI and that provides DPI to, you know, to your LPs, that's the more important thing than recycling. If you're already returned the fund, you're in the black, and it's just a matter of how much you're going to return, then it feels like maybe recycle it if you have the opportunity. Like, if Lovable is available and you had $1 million return, putting $1 million into Lovable in a $10 million fund, and now it returns 5x, and now it's, you know, you're at 15 million returns of the fund. It could be whatever, really accretive, you know.
Jason, for founders out there who are listening and may not be familiar with capital recycling, can you just break that down for the folks out there?
Super simple. In fund documents, when you get the first returns back, if you had a $10 million fund, you might say, we're going to recycle the first 10% of funds that come back. So if you have any early wins, instead of distributing the $1 million, which LPs probably don't want a quick win of 10% of what they put in, if somebody put in 100K, getting a 10K check is nice, but not life-changing. Hey, maybe we take that million. We know there's a winner in this portfolio. It's, you know, that Nectar company. And hey, let's put the million into Nectar and we'll be alongside True Ventures and we'll have even more ownership in what we believe is a, you know, really high conviction bet. So it's just a way to goose the eventual returns of the fund. You know, now if you didn't have any winners in the fund or breakouts yet, and you couldn't identify them, then you probably would want to just distribute those returns to your LPs.
Just because they probably don't want to take on extra risk at that point in time?
Yeah, they would probably want you to work towards doubling or tripling the money. What as an LP in 21 funds right now, it's too many. I've been saying no to a lot of people. I said to everybody, like, if you double the money I gave you, and it's just basically like stock market returns, I'm happy because I don't need access to this capital anyway. It doesn't need to be liquid. It's like a wealth bomb for my daughters down the road. But if you quadruple it or 5X it, then it's meaningful for me and I'm stoked. And if I can get bill relationships or get intelligence from Sophia, you know, she's got this great company, Nectar, and what was it? Nectar Social?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nectar Social.
Like, okay, like if I ask Sophia, can I get an intro? She'd be like, sure, you're an LP. Of course I'll give you an intro. Like, and Mark Andreessen specifically does this. He was an LP on my first fund, but we had a mini micro falling out because he wouldn't come on the pod. Then why are you an LP? And he's like, well, do I have to come on the pod to be an LP? And I said, you know, now that I think of it, yes. And he's like, okay. And I was like, okay. We haven't really spoken since. I mean, we had a couple little back and forths, but
that was a little petty than why he blocked me. Okay. Well, on that note, Sophia, I think it's very interesting that you brought up Lovable because they are such an amazing breakout company from Sweden, if memory serves, and you're based over in the UK. So I'm curious, are AI startups in the European area performing as poorly as some American VCs think? Because there's been quite a meme lately of, you know, America builds, Europe regulates, Europe's dead, etc. But Lovable seems to break that mold. So I'm curious, is it?
I'm right here, Alex. You could just say Jason.
So Jason hates Europe, and especially France. Every
no,
time
I just don't think I'm going to find the next unicorn there in all likelihood. That's all. Certainly well, not in France.
Is that correct, Sophia, or are we being a bit too freedom fries over here?
I've been here 4 months, right? So, I mean,
you're an expert. And,
you know,
go.
You should speak
I'm definitely not an expert.
English people.
You know, I think, you know, I've spent a bunch of time with, like, Brent Hoberman and Founders Forum and went to the Founders Forum event a couple months ago and spoke at London Tech Week and whatever. So I'm like just immersing myself in the ecosystem. But, you know, I think, you know, Founders Forum was really exciting. There were some exciting companies. The founder of Lovable spoke, founder of Perplexity spoke. But in terms of Europe, I feel like Estonia And is there's like the concentration of startups in Estonia and the you know, how it lends itself to being, you know, founder friendly or whatever. I read about it and I forgot the details, but it seems like Estonia is kind of having a moment.
Isn't that where Skype was from originally? Am I crazy? Jason, back me up here. Skype?
No, I think they were Swedes, but they might have been from an Eastern Bloc country. You might be right. There were three founders. So,
we're both right. It was founded by Sweden, people from Sweden and Denmark, but was primarily developed in Estonia.
Got it. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, you know, the Nordics are special because those people have a design aesthetic that is really high, and it's really cold and there's nothing to do for 6 months of the year, so they just work. Whereas in France, Italy, Spain, it's lovely. Why would you spend 12 hours working on your startup, 14 hours? Why would you give up a weekend? If I lived in Italy, I would not be working on my podcast. And I would be out and about. I would be getting pasta, branzino, whatever. And the lifestyle does drive. I've seen this in every single local market. If the lifestyle is amazing, you got rich parents, cost of living is low, people are going to go out and just have fun and live their life. If the nightlife sucks, and there's nothing to do, like San Francisco, like literally, if you're in Palo Alto, your last meal is 9 p.m. unless you're going to like the 24-hour Denny's. Like there's like two choices, Denny's and like an Arby's by the airport. Like that's it. You know, even in an Outburger closes like at midnight in the Bay Area. So
this is why I never actually believed the VCs who said that Miami was the next big startup town. I'm like, it's way too much fun.
It's kind of boring. I think San Francisco, I'm way more social. I have way more fun in San Francisco than Miami.
That's because you like Ryan, to go to hackathons. That's about you, Ryan.
Yeah. I was
Ryan's
about to say,
not
Ryan,
going to
I'm
the club
you.
Or surfing. Are you surfing in LA? What are you doing?
I went surfing the first time this year in Costa Rica. Okay. It was
so you
fun.
Didn't get the bug. Yeah. If you got the bug, you'd be out
injured.
There surfing
old,
4
remember?
Days a week.
Yeah.
That's when you know you're fucked with your investment, is when the founder is surfing 4 or 5 days a week. LA is amazing for lifestyle. Sophia knows that.
It is. I have zero companies in LA.
I mean, getting people to work hard is my, like, I've developed strategies around it, but I have now realized, like, working hard and putting in 10, 12-hour days and effort is for 10% of the population. Like having a career, I think, is for 20% of the population. I think just everybody else's live to work to live now. The number of people, and it's a generational thing, and it's no judgment, it's just the observation.
So I think that's changed.
Big time.
Yeah. I just hosted Trust Fund's first founder residency in Mallorca for a week. And so invited all my portfolio companies out. I was like, I rented this I mean, I've very the management fees on a $5 million fund aren't very high, but I dropped like it was probably a $20,000 expense, and I got this like 7-room villa and was like, if you want to come out here, I've got this, I'll feed you. I ordered a chef one night, we went out to different restaurants, we went to the beach once, we went on a boat, which was like amazing.
Did people co-work?
They co-worked, yeah, and I sat with them. I'm like, oh cool, I get to be in Spain, be near the ocean, these guys get to sit near a pool. We had to talk about, like, you know, whatever latest thing they're paying attention to or reading, and all educate each other. I get to sit there and mentor them, like, on my time zone, and everybody kind of, like, gets what they want and, like, get to build relationships. So I'm really excited to institutionalize that into the fund because it's, like, a selfish...
Genius.
You know? I feel like...
No, it's genius.
It's just, like, no talks. It's totally unstructured. You know?
What I love about your idea is that's going to inform your follow-on investment. It's also, they're going to help each other. So we call them jam sessions. We do something similar, but it's just a jam session or a pod. So we have our companies get together and do a pod where they meet every month. And we have 11 investment team members. So they have about 30 potential founders in their pod. They get 5 to 10 to show up every month. They share what they're working on, what their challenges are. You go around the circle and they help each other. And we're just facilitators, and founders love meeting with other founders because my thesis, Ryan, is founders are mutants. And like, I get to be Professor X, you know, like we're the school for mutants, and they feel uncomfortable around humans, but they feel very comfortable when they're with other mutants. when you see those great scenes from the X-Men movies when they're in the school together, they're like joyful and fun and nobody's being judged because like I can make an ice cube, you can light something on fire, I can walk through walls. Yeah, we all have something we can do that's an incredible skill. But then you put them with humans and it's like they're misunderstood, you know, and they're just
They don't trust. I mean, there's a lot of empathy and like trust that's we used to actually do this at Weekend Fun. We just opened it up to the portfolio saying, hey, we're gonna do a Zoom hang. There's gonna be max 5-7 of us. And we're just going to chat about like what we're working on, what challenges you have. And yeah, there's more trust. And of course, you put that same person in front of like a VC, especially, or their team, like they're going to act different. They have to look confident. They can't be honest. It's a totally different, it's an environmental thing.
Is there a way do you have like a Slack channel for your founders? Is there?
We have a Slack instance, yeah.
You do they use it?
It's unbelievably popular. We have 400 portfolio companies in the 12 years I've been doing this, from a Sequoia Scout, an AngelList syndicate to now. And we even have the failed companies in there that are shut down and we let them stay there. And we have an accounting tax channel, growth channel, and we have their channels, and we have our entire investment team in each of the private channels for their companies. And we'll talk to them there and they help each other. It's not us leading it. They lead it. And then this book phase, I think it's a great thing to do. Persistent, great place to do it. You have to also staff all these things. So as a fund, especially a small one, you got to pick, like, you can't start 20 programs. You got to pick the three most effective that you enjoy. So what's great about the one you chose, Sophia, is you like to be in a great Airbnb in a city and try new food. You're like me. You're a foodie. You like to travel. Ryan likes to be on his computer. He wants product hunt. He's obsessed with being on his computer
and
products.
No, Ryan's a surfer.
No, he's surfing. Yeah, right. Ryan he's surfed.
Yeah.
Once.
I have once.
But Ryan really likes to be online. He's addicted to being online in online communities. He created one of the great online communities of all time, Product Hunt. That's, you can always tell it's a great community if it still exists. Product Hunt still exists. So that means it's a great community that got product fit. So that works for you, Ryan. You like to co-work. Sophia or I co-working for 5 hours on a Zoom might be death. Like, we might be like, oh, it's draining to be on a Zoom.
Yeah. It's so draining, you guys. I have to go. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's why we came here for. All right, what are the news stories? Let's do a lightning round of news stories. This has been great, guys. It's just great to catch up with you two and share notes.
I was so intimidated. I still get so intimidated about joining podcasts for whatever reason, unless, you know, most people just want me to babble about my life and it's like really easy to talk about yourself, but talking about smart people things, I'm like, am I smart? I'm just always asking myself if I'm smart enough.
So full of it. I know your shtick. You're like, I've only built a $350 million company.
Stop. It was overvalued.
Not your fault.
You just constantly, you've nailed it.
Sorry,
like self-deprecating.
And no, then, imagine being inside my head. It's fucked.
But you're just saying that's the same thing.
I always send
say.
You. I always send Sophia a thumbs up or a heart on her social just to let her know, like, you're doing good, girl. Keep
Thank
going.
You
can do it. All right. You know, I always like to give everybody the ability to plug a startup or two or an investment or two that they're super excited about. What do you got, Sophia? And maybe Alex, we can show whatever she pulls
somehow,
up.
Somehow, when you were talking about portfolio companies working together, one thing that's really cool is one of my portfolios, well, Nectar Social, is a customer of Agree.com, and Agree are another one of the breakout companies I invested in pre-seed. They're basically going to replace DocuSign, and what they're creating is a signature to payments flow where when somebody signs an agreement and there's an invoice associated with it, they pay before the flow is over. So you don't necessarily have to send an invoice. And so they have a lot of SaaS companies. They work with Beehive. I made a TikTok about them, and I guess like they got like a 4 million customer with like $4 million a year in revenue, like who like found them on my TikTok, which is like really cool. But yeah, they've got like 40,000 customers. They came to me through, I literally like look through the, you know, the pitches that come through the website, and most of them are like consumer, just like off thesis. And I looked at this and it was like agree.com. And I was like, what's this? So they just literally like cold pitched me. They could have gotten to me, like we know mutual people, but they cold pitched me and I was like, this. And they just raised like a $10.2 million seed round like a year after their pre-seed, so. Yeah.
And Sophia, you also mentioned Baton.
Yeah. So Baton Market, I invested at seed. They just raised their Series A from Obvious Ventures. And so they are building a marketplace for SMBs to find qualified buyers and for people who want to buy mostly like local kind of ugly businesses, I guess, is the trend. You know, profitable businesses, someone who might be doing like a roll up of like dry cleaners or, you know, yoga studios or coffee shops. And so Baton Market makes it really easy for people to acquire companies. They're doing amazing jobs. So.
Awesome. Now, Ryan, you sent in three companies of yourself. I believe one of them was Deel, which we've already talked about. But you also mentioned Atlas, which is a very interesting company that I did not see coming.
Yeah, Atlas is so I met in Mohawk. We invested in the C round. It's gone on to raise a Series A and B. And what they're building is a sort of a layer to apply for a visa, particularly starting with Indian travelers. Us in the U.S., we sort of have an advantage. Like, we don't need to apply for visas, you know, for a lot of different places to travel. But for Indian, you know, consumers, they need to apply for visas. They have to go to these like janky government websites and wait a long time. And they basically created this really clever wrapper, not in the negative sense, but a wrapper around this entire experience where you can actually apply and do everything within the mobile app. And it also shows like your tracking and everything. And it's just a really interesting space. It's a massive market that I think a lot of people are overlooking. And my favorite part about Atlas is Mohawk, in the very beginning, he was just like effectively building APIs on top of government websites through like web scraping was how they started. So it's like, all right, these government websites don't have APIs. They're not like modern. Let me just like effectively build our own API and build on top of that. And, you know, this is also a time like right before COVID hit, which is also an interesting time to be building a business like this. So anyway, I love the CEO Mohawk and what he's building there and just creating like more flexibility and convenience with traveling is just, I think, a net positive for the world too.
Okay, Jason, what do you got?
So we just wrapped up Launch Accelerator 34. And two companies that really got a lot of attention. One was Autolane, which is by a serial founder. He previously had a company called Neighbourly, which rented storefronts. And Neighbourly was this great idea that died during COVID, victim of the COVID wars. But you would take a storefront and people could go there and rent it by the hour for a book club, for a rehearsal dinner, for an offsite. And people loved it. And there was all this extra, you know, if you live in LA and you've been to like, I don't know, West Hollywood, there's all these storefronts, or Montana, or, you know, there's all these storefronts everywhere. And so imagine taking one of them and making it an Airbnb, essentially. Anyway, that failed. He came to me with this new idea, Autolane. He said, you know, self-driving's here. And I said, yeah, I'm aware. I got a couple of investments in that space. And he said, people are going to be doing self-driving deliveries and pickups. I said, say more. He said, imagine your Walmart, HEB is the big chain of like grocery stores in Texas where I live. And you have a Tesla coming to pick stuff up, a DoorDash car, an Uber. I'm like, well, they have all those coming. He's like, yeah, it's chaos already. Now imagine you add 10 different fleets of automated cars. So they're building the operating system to manage that. So they sell into a Walmart or to these other places. You can pull up the website. And that gives them software to know, hey, these are the parking spots for the automated vehicles. And Ryan owns a Tesla Model Y. Ryan, you might send your car to the Central Market or this Whole Foods. That's a distinct possibility. So instead of ordering from Instacart, imagine, Ryan, you ordered from Whole Foods, and then Whole Foods brought it out to the curb and put it in the back of your car.
Autonomously, I was like, without me being there.
Without you doing it, but it's your car.
Yeah, right.
Or so now, Sophia, imagine like, oh, you get dropped off at work and then it goes and picks up your Erewhon lunch and your team lunch and then brings it back to your office and parks in your parking spot. How does that whole handoff at Erewhon work? Then imagine Erewhon or, I don't know, pick a company, Domino's Pizza decides they want to own the fleet. So Domino's Pizza says, okay, we're going to have 5 Model Ys, or Waymo is selling their technology to Toyota now, and Volkswagen has their own thing. So they buy 5 Volkswagens and they decide they're going to send these Volkswagen IDs out to deliver pizza. Well, they still need an operating system to manage all that. So anyway, he's building that operating system and all the handoff, and he's super early. But what was amazing is this founder is a fundraising machine. And that's a new criteria for me. We have 13 criteria for investing. Product velocity is one of them, world-class design, serial founder, and alumni of our programs. This person has all of those, but he's also a fundraising machine. So I added that as one of our 14th fundraising machine as a tag for like a founder we love. Because we have some founders who are great at product velocity and great ideas and great at recruiting, but for some reason they can't raise money. Infuriating and frustrating because it's like they have all the other qualities. So anyway, I love that one. And then another one that's really interesting, this team I think came out of Google or Uber, I can't remember. And it's called Doctors. And you may have heard people are doing self-directed healthcare. And where you're seeing self-directed healthcare most of all is in travel, elective surgeries. I don't know what they call those, but elective surgeries and traveling to places where you have the highest rated providers and the lowest price.
Medical tourism?
Medical tourism, thank you. So medical tourism is part of a subset of a bigger theme of self-directed healthcare, which I think like Superpower, Whoop, Aura, Eat Sleep, that's all like self-directed healthcare. This is different. This is like elective. So people are going for dentistry to Mexico, stem cells to, you know, Panama, all types of augmentations and facelifts in South Korea. So they started with hair transplants in Turkey. And then their secret that they figured out that nobody else did is this is all happening on TikTok. And there was this like fear that people had. Is this safe? Should I do this? And then there's the people who are, you know, have these centers in Turkey and they're trying to convince people it's safe. And it turns out TikToks help people bridge that gap. And so that's their first one. And then the next one I didn't know was in Spain, Portugal, France, freezing your eggs and doing IVF is like $5,000. And in the United States, it's $30,000. So now people are going to two harvest cycles for 60 days. And it's like, so I asked them, like, when people do that, are they doing it because it's that much cheaper? Or are they doing it because they want to have a two-month vacation in Spain or Portugal or France? And you know what they said to me? Yes. It's both. You can spend $5,000, get an Airbnb for $5,000, have an incredible, relaxing 60 days in France, harvest your stuff, and but you need to have some marketplace between them. And so they're the marketplace between them. So there's two that just graduated last week, or this week, actually, from the Launch Accelerator. If you want to come to the Launch Accelerator, launch.co/apply. We've done 34 cohorts. It's been really fun.
All right. Well, friends, that brings us to a wrap for today. And Sophia, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find Trust Fund and where can people find you on the great wide internet?
Trustfund.vc. And then I'm Sophia Amoruso pretty much everywhere.
Pretty much everywhere.
Instagram Brian? You're big on Instagram. That's TikTok?
Yeah. I don't spend as much time. I don't always cross post, but yeah, I'm just focused on Instagram. I'm an elder millennial.
Yeah. Elder millennial Instagram. Right. Yeah. I'm a Gen X, so I'm on X.com/Twitter. Yeah. Where are you, Millennial Ryan?
Millennial Ryan. I'm on Twitter. That's where I spend most of the time. R.R. Hoover. And I'm not on TikTok. I mean, there is a TikTok. You'll find it if you search, but I'm not gonna say it's good content.
And the website is weekend.fund, I believe.
That's right.
Yep. And we're launch.co.
There you go.
With no M. I'm still trying to get the launch.com, but I'm fine with the launch.co. Founder.university, which is our pre-accelerator where we teach people how to start companies, which will be coming to Saudi. We've press release went out. I haven't really talked about it too much publicly, but Founder University's second city in the world will be, after the United States, is going to be in Saudi. And then I'll probably bring it to two other countries in 2026. We're announced two countries in 2026. And I'm at Jason on Instagram and at Jason on the Twitter X.
All right. Well, we're back on Friday. Thank you all very much. We'll see you then. This has been Twist.